Melissa, host of Mercury Falls. Join me Wednesday nights from 9 to 11 for an avant adventure in all things audio here on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. Kingston City Council got answers in the form of a comprehensive information report on the feasibility of using beet-based and similar alternative de-icing products for Kingston Winter Road maintenance practices during their May 5th council meeting. Following a request by council at their March 24th meeting, as previously covered by CFRC LGI reporter Christina Laurie, the study explored the feasibility and potential impacts of alternative products, including beet juice, molasses-based products, cheese processing brine, distillery byproducts, and more from multiple perspectives. The report found that beet juice-based additives did not provide meaningful advantages over existing practices and introduced new challenges in the form of increased costs, negative environmental impact, and additional infrastructure requirements. The report estimated an upfront cost of $160,000 for new storage infrastructure, the rental of an additional winter maintenance vehicle, and an additional 6-10% material cost for the beet juice-based additive. This estimate did not include the repair and maintenance costs for clogged or damaged equipment. While the environmental impacts of road salt, including potential harm to aquatic life, soil degradation, and increased corrosion of vehicles, bridges, and other infrastructure was noted, the report asserts that Kingston's current maintenance program uses a coordinated and proactive approach to minimize the environmental impact of salt and already aligns with national best practices for reducing road salt. In addition, environmental impact studies done by researchers at Queen's University have found that beet-based additives may pose greater risk to freshwater ecosystems than traditional salt, with its high sugar content causing a 68-fold decrease in dissolved oxygen levels. Beet juice additives are not new, with several municipalities including Toronto, Barrie, London, Chatham, and Belleville exploring their use in winter maintenance in the late 2000s, with the hopes that this agricultural byproduct could reduce salt use and lessen environmental impact. The results of these studies showed minimal improvement over existing products and an increase in pretreatment costs of 35% on average. Complaints of clogged equipment, staining, odor, and the need for special heated storage have led to all but one supplier discontinuing beet-based additive programs entirely. The last recorded sale of beet juice-based additive de-icing material in the province was to the City of London in 2021. Councillor Osanek thanks city staff for their report.
Thanks for staff for looking into the beet juice. Now we know, and I'm fine with the way that it's written, that it's too expensive to do, and also that it's not as effective as people have led on that it has been. So now we know. If anyone asks us, you know, next winter, we have a report that we can refer to.
She also noted that the sugar left behind by beet juice has a potential to attract wildlife to the side of the road and asked that this be included in the report.
Because beet juice is sweet, the sugar content that is then left on the road can actually attract wildlife to the road, such as deer. And deer to me, they also mentioned reptiles like turtles. And the last thing we want is to attract turtles onto our roadways in the springtime.
Councillor Tozo expressed his disappointment in the findings, but remained pragmatic.
I am disappointed we can't use beet-based solutions. And I'm really disappointed Councillor Boehm isn't here, because this was his motion. The beat goes on, I guess.
The findings of this report will be incorporated into expected updates to the city's next minimum maintenance standards review of its winter maintenance program and salt management plan. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report for Monday, May 11th, 2026. The Kingston Grenadiers Youth Football Club will kick off their 2026 season on May 16th in Ottawa. A not-for-profit, volunteer-run youth development program, the Kingston Grenadiers played their inaugural season in 2004 as part of a U18 AAA football organization known at the time as the Ontario Varsity Football League, since renamed to the Ontario Summer Football League. After five seasons of strictly U18 play, the club expanded to offer a U16 program in 2009. After a temporary stint as the Kingston Junior Gales in 2022, the team went back to the Grenadier branding in 2023 and also began to expand its services, fielding U14 and U12 teams. Over 200 players will suit up for the Grenadiers in 2026 across their four age cohorts, and of those 200, roughly 10% will be coming from low-income backgrounds. The coaching staff is composed of volunteers, many recruited from the high school coaching ranks in the area. While the club struggled to find success in the 2010s, the program has turned a corner in recent years, consistently fielding championship-caliber teams in multiple age brackets. Expectations are particularly high for the 2026 U18 squad after a 7-0 regular season in 2025. Six players from the U18 Grenadiers were selected to play in the Football Ontario Red Black Weekend, including defensive end Adrian Stangetta, running back Declan Cowan, and H-back Tom Alliver. The 2026 home opener will be played on May 23rd at Richardson Stadium, starting with the U12 team at 11 a.m. and concluding with the U18 team at 6:30 p.m. Tickets can be purchased from the Richardson Stadium box office on game day. In other Kingston sports news, Queens offensive lineman and the second overall pick in the CFL draft, Nicholas Hennig, has announced that he has signed a contract with the Las Vegas Raiders of the National Football League. Hennig is the sixth player in program history to make the jump to the NFL. He joins running back Jim Young, 1965, running back Hino Lillis, 1966, who was also a practice squad player for the Dallas Cowboys, offensive tackle Mike Shad, a 1986 first-round draft pick for the LA Rams, the only U Sports player ever selected in the first round, Brad Elberg, 1993, who played for the Philadelphia Eagles, and most recently, offensive tackle Matt O'Donnell, who in 2011 signed with the Cincinnati Bengals. It is unlikely that Hennig will dress for the Raiders in 2026, but he is a shrewd developmental signing for a team that is talent-starved on the offensive line, who also recently drafted a new quarterback with the first overall pick in the 2026 NFL Draft. Whether it's Vegas or Toronto, there is no doubt that the Milton, Ontario product has a bright future ahead of him in professional football. Coming up next on Today in YGK, we go to Christina Laurie with an update on the future of the Addictions Treatment Center in Kingston.
At their last meeting, council once again tackled the uncertain future of Kingston's addiction services. It was announced in March that Consumption and Treatment Services, CTS, which has operated alongside the Integrated Care Hub since 2018, would close effective September 30th, 2026. The CTS serves hundreds of vulnerable residents annually, preventing overdose deaths and diverting emergency room visits. This closure is due to the provincial decision to cut funding to CTS sites across Ontario, effective June 13th. After much uncertainty about what would come next, the province announced on April 10th that a new Homelessness and Addiction Recovery Treatment Hub, or HEART Hub, will be established in Kingston. Provincial HEART Hubs will provide services related to addiction recovery, primary care, and supportive housing. However, unlike the CTS model, HEART Hubs require abstinence as a condition of access and will not provide services like drug checking, needle exchange, and safe consumption. Counselors and local experts alike have acknowledged there will be significant gaps upon the closure of CTS. In a lengthy meeting in March, council began discussing what the CTS closure means and how the city will navigate it. At their meeting on Tuesday, May 5th, now with the knowledge of a confirmed heart hub from the province, council continued the conversation. A motion from the Arts, Recreation, and Community Policies Committee came before council, laying out a multi-part response to the looming closure of Kingston's CTS site. Two pieces focus on understanding the impact. Council asks the city's chief administrative officer to report back on what the provincial decision will mean for the integrated care hub, everything from the building lease to programming. Staff are also being directed to work with Kingston Community Health Centers to collect detailed data on harm reduction services to paint a clearer picture of what's being lost. There's also a communications component aimed at making sure residents know where to turn. The city will work with local partners to share information about available supports once the CTS site closes. The most notable parts of the motion are two more action-focused items. First, council is directing the city solicitor, alongside the mayor and chief administrative officer, to formally assess whether the situation warrants a municipal declaration of emergency. That assessment is expected back in the third quarter of 2026. Second, council is committing $350,000 in new funding to support community-driven solutions. The money will go toward pilot projects proposed by local organizations, with a focus on new harm reduction initiatives that can potentially operate at a lower cost. Councillor Brandon Tozzo added one more item to the list with an amendment: that council formally opposed the provincial government's decision to close CTS.
I think that there's a substantial amount of work on the financial side has been done, but I think it's important that we send a clear message to the community where we as a political body stand on this. This closing of this will cause harm. It will affect a vulnerable community. And I want us to just make it a position that we fully oppose the closure of the CTS in the city of Kingston.
Councillors Gary Osteroff and Jimmy Hassan were opposed to the amendment. Osteroff was supportive of the new Heart Hub model as a replacement, and Hassan pointed to the provincial responsibility for healthcare matters.
I can't support this. I believe that the heart and with addiction recovery, I believe that it's the better way to go. So I can't support this.
I think it's not a good strategy to just oppose their decision. That was their decision. That's their department. That's their responsibility. So we have to live with it, but we'll continue to support whatever, however we can do. I will not support this amendment.
Mayor Brian Patterson, who seconded the amendment, spoke to the importance of CTS's place in the addiction care ecosystem in addition to a heart hub.
I think it was Councillor Ridge, who is not here tonight, who I think put it very eloquently when we first debated this, said what we really need is a CTS and a heart hub. This is not about suggesting that we're not in favor of the heart hub. The heart hub is great. It's a huge new investment into the community that will offer hope and recovery for those that are struggling with addiction. I'm a huge supporter of it, and I can hardly wait to see it up and running. What I'm suggesting, and I think that what has been discussed, is that ideally you would have both so that you can have a place where you can meet people where they're at. Obviously, not everybody is ready to immediately move into recovery. So allow them to be able to access harm reduction services and then be able to transition into the heart hub. I think you could see both of those working together. So this is really, in my view, I was happy to second this because I think it just shows on principle that if it was up to us, we would want both. It's not in any way poking at the province, where I think we've been very vocal that we've been helpful or very grateful for the heart hub. But I think it still is very clear that ideally you would have both. So for that reason, I'm happy to second this amendment.
The amendment passed with a vote of 8-2. Councillors Osteroff and Hassan opposed. When discussion returned to the full motion, Councillor Jeff McLaren spoke in support, especially noting the importance of the $350,000 in funding for new projects and the opportunity for change.
This came as a result of ideas that were coming from the public that could help support the city's harm reduction efforts at a lower cost. And since we are looking for ways to save money, it seems that this is an opportunity to see if that could happen. That's the whole point of this pilot project. Take ideas from people on the front lines that want to start new enterprises, social enterprises that actually benefit people in a new and different way. I think this is a great way forward, and I hope that it succeeds, because what we've been doing up until now seems to be getting, making, no. The situation seems to be getting worse, regardless of what we continue to throw, the money we throw at it. So it's time to find some new ideas, and hence the word new community groups and new proposals.
Councillor Connie Glenn also spoke in support of the motion, with hope for the future of services in Kingston, but still bracing for the impact of the CTS site closure.
I'm very heartened to see this motion coming forward, and I hope that it's going to pass. I think I feel a positive wind here. I do believe that pilot projects may lead to some gold nuggets. We have deep-seated challenges here, and removal of support for the CTS is eventually going to hit this community really hard. So I think one of the things that needs to be reiterated here is that removal of these sites in other municipalities has led to an increase in overdoses. It's led to increased emergency room visits. Hamilton's one of the places that's been mentioned a few times that's seen this sort of thing happen. So I'm glad that we're going to do what we can to bridge the gap and hopefully preserve some services and see where we go from there. But in the short term, I think this is the right step forward for us. And then we'll have to have more conversations about how we get those other gaps filled and how we get the province to fill them for us, because we can't continue this way as we've seen with our budgetary pressures.
In the end, the motion carried with a vote of 9-1. Councillor Gary Osteroff opposed. Addiction and Mental Health Services, KFLNA, will be the lead agency for the new Heart Hub services. For now, the city clarified in a release that Kingston Community Health Center's Street Health Center will continue to provide primary care, addiction treatment, and harm reduction services. Low barrier services like the Access and Support Center, Rest Zone, and other integrated care hub programming will continue through and after the transition to a Heart Hub.
Hopefully things will not deteriorate any further with the interventions that we're putting in place.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Coming up next, we have your weather and traffic reports. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, May 11th, daytime high of 12 degrees with a 30% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Tuesday, May 12th, 11 degrees is your high, but it's going to feel a lot warmer, close to 18 degrees in the bright sunshine. It is going to cool down quite a bit overnight, however, as we will have a daytime high of just 11 degrees on Wednesday, May 13th, with a 68% chance of precipitation. It will stay consistently cool going into the following Thursday, May 14th. 11 is your high with a 60% chance of precipitation. It's going to feel closer to 7 degrees. It is going to get nice for the weekend, though, folks. Friday, May 15th, daytime high of 14 degrees. Beautiful sunshine making it feel closer to 17. Saturday, May 16th, daytime high of 16, feeling like 20 in the sunshine. That's more like it for the month of May. Sunday, May 17th, daytime high of 17 degrees, feeling 17 degrees in the sunshine. And then kicking off next week, we've got a run of warmer weather starting with Monday, May 18th, daytime high of 18 degrees, feeling like 20. Now, that is what I'm talking about. On Bath Road between Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays as crews continue installing intersection pedestrian signals. Over on King Street West from Country Club Drive to Front Road, expect delays as Utilities Kingston Work has reduced traffic to one lane in each direction. At the intersection of Montreal Street and John Counter Boulevard, construction is ongoing throughout the month of May. Cranbrook Street and Days Road to Lakeview Avenue will be closed from 3:20 to 3:50 p.m. this afternoon as part of the School Streets program, restricting access during school drop-off and pickup times. Wright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsland Crescent for roadway repairs and safety improvements. Construction continues on Princess Street from Frontenac to Division as part of a major reconstruction project. And long-term closures remain in place on Aberdeen Street between Johnson and William and Barry and Queen. Over now to CFRC's arts correspondent, Genevieve Hinch, with your weekly concert and events report.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar. Whether you're looking for live music, a night out with friends, local markets, comedy, or karaoke, we've got plenty happening around the city, so let's get into it. Starting off Monday, if your leadership role has been stressing you out lately, Queen's is hosting a Managing Time as a Leader workshop online from 10 a.m. to noon. Later that evening, sing your heart out at karaoke night at the Timeout Bar starting at 6. And for those jazz fans in Kingston, you can head over to the RCHA Club for Inner Harbor Jazz that night. Tuesday brings a collage-making workshop at the Tet Center at 6:30, while Splitsville hosts Pride Rainbow Bowl from 7 to 9 p.m. For live music that evening, Eric Urin and Megan Below will be bringing guitar and fiddle tunes to the Cove Inn starting at 5. Over at the Grand Theatre, the on-stage season launch kicks off at 7:30 p.m. that night, featuring performances and previews for upcoming artists and productions. On Wednesday, Queen's is offering a wearable reflection jewelry making workshop in McCory Hall at noon. The Central Branch Library is also hosting a career conversation and dinner event for teens planning life after school. If board games are more your thing, both Something in the Water Brewing Co. and Royal Canadian Legion Branch 560 are hosting game nights. Need a laugh? Head over to the Merchant Tap House for Comedy Night, featuring Sterling Scott and Al Babcock. Live music includes folk artist Sam Wood at Signal Brewing Company and country guitar legend Bill Kirchen at the Hotel Wolf Island. Thursday keeps things busy with Springer Market Square running from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. if you're looking to support some local businesses. Later on, test your luck at Drag Bingo at Daft Brewing from 7 to 9 p.m. or head over to La Vida Bistro Bar and Social for their weekly music social at 9:30. Curtis Chaffee performs at the Cove Inn while Hellhound Trail takes over Hotel Wolf Island later that night. Wow, Friday is packed with live music and nightlife. Starting things off with TGIF Happy Hour at the RCHA Club from 4 to 6 p.m. Then karaoke returns to both the Buckle and Daft Brewing at 9 p.m. For live shows, Bosco, Baker, and the Doommakers bring Street Swing to the Cove Inn, while music of Stranger Things Live by Candlelight takes over the Sphere at 7. Spencer Evans performs at the Timeout Bar while Whiskey Smoke hits the RCHA Club later in the evening. And Ryan Ziggs and the Zags close out the night at the Toucan. Heading into Saturday, start the day outdoors at the Tree, Shrub, and Wildflower Sale at the Lemoyne Point Conservation Area from 9 a.m. to noon. Later on, there's line dancing at the Buckle starting at 7 and Afrobeats Night at Daft Brewing at 11. Live music includes Retro Kings at Spearhead Brewing Company during the afternoon, Suzanne Jarvie's album launch at Hotel Wolf Island, Dr. Bombay at the Turnanog, and Ice Gods performing at the Merchant Tap House. Wrapping things up, on Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. For film lovers, the screening room is showing Summer with Monica at both 4 and 6 p.m. if you're interested. Live music includes Flamenco on Tour at Hotel Wolf Island, Royal Tusk performing at the Broom Factory as a part of a KPP concert, and live band karaoke at the Merchant Tap House starting at 9. And that is your weekly events and concerts calendar for May 11th through the 17th. For more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present new music by Ironhound, one of Kingston's newest heavy metal acts. The band just released their two-track demo debut called Cinder Speed Rockin'. With a classic sound and serious momentum, Ironhound are ready to make their mark on the local scene. Follow them at Ironhound Band on Instagram to learn more and catch them at local shows. Kingston artists who want to be highlighted next time can complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Speed Rockin' by Ironhound on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Are you between 14 and 30 years old and interested in organizing a French language activity for youth in your community? The VIF program can make it happen. You could receive $850 to create your activity, and your partnering organization could get $150 to support it. Bring your idea to life. Visit programvif.ca and apply today.
Got a spring project on the horizon? Whether you're planting a garden, building a deck, installing a fence, or digging a hole for a new tree, don't forget to click before you dig. Utility lines can be just below the surface, and hitting one can cause major damage, service disruptions, or even serious injury. Visit OntarioOneCall.ca before you start to request a free utility locate. Single address requests require at least 5 business days, while larger or multi-property projects may require up to 10 business days. They'll mark out where it's safe to dig so you can work with confidence. Remember, click before you dig. It's the law. For more information, visit utilitieskingston.com.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is edition 316. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be speaking with Samer Jaber, who is a Palestinian researcher and author. He is currently a PhD candidate in political economy at Royal Holloway University in London. He studies specifically the ways that capitalist technology builds structural capacity that impacts low-income communities. He looks at that specifically in the context of Egypt. Samer has been a longtime political organizer. He's a Palestinian from Jerusalem, and he regularly publishes opinion articles about struggles on the ground in Palestine. I wanted to ask him about the long arc of grassroots Palestinian organizing for an end to the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, and then also throughout Palestine. And it was really, I think, an important conversation to sort of locate this moment in Palestinian history within an arc of struggle. So it was really great to speak with Samer for this week's edition of Free City Radio. Here's our conversation.
First of all, thank you for having me on your program. I have been activist since I was teenage. This was during the First Intifada, and part of the activities of the First Intifada that started in 1987. It was civil disobedience and boycott actions. So this was the basic framework of our activities, but most of these activities were organized within the Palestinian society between the river and the sea. So the people and the Israeli side occupied in 1948 were engaged in certain activities that suit their living conditions. People in Jerusalem also do similar things in Gaza and the West Bank. So this is how we started the movement. And later on, and actually I spent several years in the Israeli prisons because of these activities. We continued actually, and we got a new push after the Second Intifada. And in the Second Intifada, people think that was like based on certain military actions. It's totally opposite to this. Most of these actions were civil-based actions because most of the people were engaged in these activities. And we returned again to the issue of discussing, especially since 2002, the issue of reintroducing the idea of boycott. And this started the discussion, and actually this discussion started with some colleagues who used to work for the advocacy desk at the YMCA. I later on joined them to work with them. And during that time, just to give you a brief history, then a letter came from the Higher Education Union in England to start the what they call it, the BACBI. It's boycott activities at the higher education. And BACBI started like boycott at the higher education level. And this was in late 2003, beginning of 2004. And there were a friend of mine who passed away called Adnan Atiya, who were discussing this. And Adnan asked me, hey, you were very active in this regard, what we can do. I told him I have a good experience in community organizing, but not in international organizing. So then we start discuss this, and Adnan took it forward, start discussing this with within, let me call it within the NGO's framework. I wasn't that much satisfied with the NGO's approach, because NGOs is based on funding and agenda settings and so on. But in general, there were discussion. And then we decided to issue a call. This was at the beginning of the 2005. And this call started from the YMCA in Beit Sahur. It's next to Jerusalem, actually, not far away. If you know the area, it's been in Bethlehem area. But basically, it's part of Jerusalem historically. And we just issued a call. Since that time, I worked since that time till 2008 at the YMCA. Then I left because of my education. I left the United States. In the United States, I was a little bit fortunate to be exposed to different experiences, especially, and I would say it proudly, I was exposed to the Jewish activism in the United States. Because Jewish activism in the United States, you know, there is a good part of it that, because I took a course at Kennedy School with Marshall Ganz, and he was the guy who was organizing with the farmers during the late 60s, during the civil rights movement, and so on. So this was a good experience. But still, we did not develop a strategy. Until now, if you look at the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, it's a general framework. And it's a decentralized movement. And this gives it strength and it also gives it some weaknesses. The strength is like every group can invent and develop their own strategy and tactics that suit their local environment. Their weaknesses, we do not have same discourse that bring us. I'll give you just one example. When you started this conversation, you highlighted this as part of the human rights issue. But other groups would frame this as decolonization and anti-settler colonialism. So from the beginning, there were discussion about this issue. And I took the side that we need to focus on framing this as part of decolonization in one side, and of the social justice question and struggle around the world. Because if we do it in this way, we are able to deconstruct the other narratives related to subjugation and racism and imperialism and workers' rights. If we look at it from this way, then we are building a historic block, something that worldwide, and it's like there is a consistency in the developing discourse and narrative. People who discussed with me this, and basically Adnan, he said if we are doing it this way, then we could lack some support from liberal groups and from other groups that do not have certain commitments or have their own different discourse regarding to the issue. I'll give you just one example, because I also discussed this with Professor Ilan Pappé, and we wrote a short article about this published at Mondwise. It's like the green movement. We are talking about the green movement, how we can relate our struggle to the green movement. Especially that a lot of Jews who like to support Israel, like, you know, they support the Keren Kayemet, the Jewish Fund for Israel, by donating them to plant some trees. So we wrote about this, like using the green issues to cover the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe. If you have been in Palestine, you will notice that a lot of forests established over Palestinian villages. There were 447 Palestinian villages and towns that were demolished and evacuated from Palestinian citizens. So most of these villages now covered by forests. So a lot of Jews, and I'm not talking about them as accusing them, but I would say that a lot of them do not know that they are donating to for not a good cause when they are trying just to make, quote-unquote, Israel green. So they are not making Israel green. They are making Israel covering the crime that took place in 1948 and later on in 1967. So we are talking about when we are addressing the Palestine question within this framework, so we are raising the question of educating others how to do things. Actually, I'm happy with the Swedish activists, what they did now. What's the name of the girl? She was in the flotilla. When she addressed this issue that you cannot be green and support the green economy, but at the same time being condoning what Israelis do. So that's why we need to develop a certain, first of all, narrative, consistent narrative, discourse, and a strategy. If we developed a narrative, then we can develop a strategy because they are interconnected with each other.
Thanks for sharing those reflections. You talked about a historical trajectory linking the first and second Intifada, and I think critically really rooted the sense of the boycott movement targeting the Israeli government as having a root directly in Palestine, understanding the collective actions in the first Intifada and, of course, in generations previously, but in a very organized and articulated way in the first Intifada as expressing opposition to buying Israeli goods. That sense of collective boycott has now traveled the world. It's internationalized. You have formations like the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. I think it could be helpful for people to understand those formations as related to the grassroots history that you're talking about that was led on the ground by Palestinians, maybe not exactly with those names, but at a grassroots level as part of an activity of collective resistance, as one tactic amongst many that was developed during the first Intifada, and that as being connected to a multi-generational strategy of fighting colonialism on the part of Palestinians. I think that's really important to mention, is that connection to articulating, as you talked about, the Palestinian struggle as not just simply about human rights, but also as part of a struggle for land and against colonization. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this point.
Yes, actually, always as a community organizer, as organizer in general, and any organizer around the world, the major things would be how to set the goal, how to maintain the momentum. Setting the goal sometimes is easy because the goal could be something that as a response for a certain things that happened. So it could be like achievable within certain framework. But sometimes, and in a matter of anti-colonial issues, it's like a long process and you need to keep a momentum. And it's not easy to have this momentum. If you look back over the last 22 months, it was up and down. So it wasn't, we were not able always to galvanize the movement to have this push to go forward. Also, I believe that this one of the most amazing movements in the last 30 years, at least 30 years, that we have this sustainable momentum for 22 months. I could say from the history that this only happened during the late 60s, beginning of 70s, during the students' movement in Europe, and during the Vietnam War in U.S. So just to have this issue. So it's not easy to make people connect for a long time to do this. Also, it's not just like you are not having fun. As an organizer, as an activist, as freedom fighter, I would say it at some point, you have other things to do. You need to live your life. You need to earn your income. So you are not part of the corporate world that provide you with funds. So I one time make this disconnection with some Jewish friends and acquaintance, and when they ask me, do you think that Israeli settlers has a grassroots movement? I said, yes. I said, how come? How those are people just organizing at the community level? I said, they are living as community. They use ideology to cement their ties, and they have achievable goals. It's like to have their own dream built on from the scratch on the ground, grabbing as much as possible of land and ethnically cleanse the others. And they organize and put the pressure. But would those people commit to what they are doing without resources like from United States, Canada, from Western Europe, like these donations? Because they spend a lot of money. Those people just leave their job and stay in these communities. And some of them spend many, many years. They do not sacrifice their lives. But when you are talking about noble causes, you are talking about people who are sacrificing their lives. Literally, they are sacrificing their lives. Independent of their background, like national background, whether they are Jews or whether they are Arabs, whether they are Europeans or Asians and or Africans, you know. And if we look just as a reflection, you know, I graduate in the master degree from a good or one of the excellent schools in the world. Like I studied at Kennedy School, at Brandeis, at MIT. Then I found myself for 5 years was not able to get a job. And I wrote about this issue and was thinking that there are group of people who work, collect data about people and have a database, so they would not allow you to, when you apply to have a job, to get your job. Then we later find, lately, over the last few years, that we have the Canary Project. And this Canary Project started in U.S. and Canada. So they already traced us when we were in the United States universities. And they would, like, spot those who are activists. And because we just were just few number of people, they can track us and do all of these issues. But now we are a movement. We are not anymore just individual activists, especially when you are talking about North America. So this part of the issues. So this part of the reflection, now we are a movement. Because we are a movement, now we need a strategy. We need this decisive strategy. And what we mean by strategy, it is like strategic goal to look at the supply chain that sustain Israel to be strong, to continue doing what they are doing.
Thanks for sharing that. In the current context, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's currently happening on the ground in Gaza. It's been a really intense moment where the stories and images and video of what's taking place on the ground in Gaza has been communicated and shared through social media. You know, people really articulated and talked about Palestinians live streaming their own genocide as part of this effort to try to mobilize people internationally to say no and to stand up. I wanted to ask about this in relation to that really important part of the story that maybe does not come through as clearly in social media because of the nature of that commodified platform. Just in the sense that a lot of the folks from Gaza that are sharing stories are, of course, connected to a broader community. And I wanted to underline here that importance of things like collective kitchens or music schools or high school teachers sustaining classrooms, you know, in displacement camps, water distribution, all these collective organizing efforts that really speak not just to individual narratives, but to the collective sustaining and resistance of Palestinians in Gaza. I would love to hear your reflections on understanding the importance of this layer of what's taking place on the ground in Gaza today. Thank you.
Yeah, what you ask about is a very important issue. I would reframe it, where is the Palestinian voice in the international organizing? This one issue and the other things, I want to highlight the activism in Palestine. First of all, what we see of activism, especially in Gaza, it's a civil-based organizing. It's not an NGO's work. And with the civil-based organizing, you see that people put their life online. They might be killed. They are doing whatever they can just to assist their own community. They are engaged as part of their own community. NGOs have very different approach, and we see that NGOs already have a lot of resources, but I would have two main experiences. Those who have, like WF, World Food Organization, WFO, and many other, including UNRWA, which is an international organization. Those people try to work within what the Israelis provided them, within what the Israelis need them to do. And we already know that there were many meetings between these international organizations, international NGOs, and the Israeli army, actually in the Layman prison, where many Palestinians were killed in that prison. And we highlighted this, and you can find this online. So when we ask the people around the world to listen to us, we need to ask to make them listen to the civil-based activities, to the community actions, the direct actions on the ground. And here, a lot of activities around the world, like either to work with international organizations or work with the Palestinian Authority. And Palestinian Authority, for many of the Palestinians, and the majority of the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, they are security collaborators, security contractors for the Israeli army, the Israeli apparatus, occupation apparatus. But if you look, for example, here like in London, whenever we have what we call it the national national demonstration, we always have the so-called Palestinian ambassador to represent the Palestinian voice. Not the Palestinian communities. The Palestinians who like represent have long history of activism to share their voices. So there's still people need, the majority of them look for certain selectively certain Palestinian voices that suit and keep them within the mainstream. And this is the issue. And here we can talk about four different Palestinian voices within Palestine. First of all, we are talking about the Gaza, and this framed by the political situation. Within Gaza, the situation is very difficult, and people who took the initiative tried to do whatever they can. Israelis do not allow them. You know, Israel tried to engineer the starvation, and from one hand, from the other hand, tried to muzzle and even kill the journalists, as what happened few hours ago when they assassinated six journalists, among them the Al Jazeera journalist Sharif. So it's like we need to give priority to Gaza. But the problem with Gaza is how to communicate with the people in Gaza. Do we communicate with the people who left Gaza? Here, we need also to raise questions. Some of those people who left Gaza have the privilege to leave Gaza. So that's one of the issues. That's why we need to give priorities for the people in Gaza. When we are talking about West Bank, we have also different political circumstances. And within West Bank, we have at least two different groups. The people who are affiliated with the Palestinian Authority and the people who are not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority. This one issue. The most of the people who are not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority, they are activists either in Area C, 60% of the West Bank, where Israel exercised full control of security control and civil control over the Palestinians. So those people take the risk, as we have seen in Masafer Yatta, for example, in the Jordan Valley, the Bedouins, those people. We need to get in touch with those people. And we see some international activism that helps those people, especially in Masafer Yatta. International Solidarity Movement doing a good job in this. In this regard. So, civil-based struggle based on democracy, human rights, but based on anti-colonial approach and based on not only civil rights and but also justice for all.
Thank you so much for the conversation today, Samer.
Thank you for having me and giving me opportunity to share my opinion.
That was a conversation with Samer Jaber, who is a PhD candidate in political economy at Royal Holloway University in London. Thank you to Samer for sharing your insights on this week's edition of the show. Free City Radio broadcasts weekly. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. You can hear us on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM. On Thursdays at 8 a.m. on CGLO, 1690 a.m., also in Montreal. On CKUW, 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. On CFRC, 101.9 FM in Kingston, on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. On CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria, on Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto, on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKUW 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also podcasts. Just look us up. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll speak to you next week.